This is Yaron Brook, guest speaking on Dr. Leonard Peikoff's podcast. I'm here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. Your real-life questions specifically to current events, including politics, economics, and foreign policy. My answers are posted every other week on Mondays. Leonard will continue to answer questions, but now only on alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes at www.peikoff.com. If you have a question to ask me, simply go to peikoff.com/questions. So this question is about gold standards. Some objectivists have strict adherence to gold, disregarding money that isn't accepted by choice, so fiat money. Is what constitutes money as a concept a part of the objectivist philosophy? Not in the sense of what metal or what form it takes, no, money, but in the sense of what it means, in a sense of its use. You know, that is part of economics. That is, you know, in a sense, that is part of what objectivism. But look, objectivism is a philosophy. A philosophy doesn't dictate the details of economics. It doesn't dictate the details of economic, you know, how an economy would function in a free market. All we say about money is that it is, you know, it is a means of exchange, and therefore it has to have a characteristic that makes it a means of exchange. And then you have to just follow the logic of what that means. And I am a strong believer that money in a free society would indeed be gold. I don't believe it would be Bitcoin. I believe it would have to be something physical, real, with some value to somebody, just in its raw form, but where the supply was limited by some feature of its nature. For example, just the very existence of gold on the planet and the difficulty of accessing it dictates how fast the growth of gold is. I think gold is just proven through history to be a good form of money. But whether it's gold or something else, if it turns out to be platinum, or if it turns out to be Bitcoin, if you could convince me that that is doable, that would not be a violation of the objectivist philosophy. So the question is, would it be moral and rational for the U.S. to default on its debts so as not to force future generations to repay it? Since the money is borrowed to pay for programs that are immoral in the first place, is it not logical to default? So my view is no, not in the current context, not in the current world we live in. I mean, on what basis would the U.S. default today? Would it stop all the immoral programs that it's engaged in? No. So there's no basis today in a mixed economy to default on that debt. So the idea is, if we were today moving towards laissez-faire capitalism, towards freedom, should the government default on all its debt as a way to wipe out the debt and that way shrink and so on? Certainly, you could imagine circumstances where that would be the case, and I think it would be moral, but it would only be moral in the context of moving towards a free society, moving towards laissez-faire, moving towards government not being involved in the economy anymore. So it would only be in the context of shrinking government expenditures, dramatic shrinkage of government expenditures, dramatic shrinking of government regulation, and a slow movement towards a separation of state from economics. If, as part of that movement, it made sense to default on the debt in order to make that movement faster, in order to make it more effective, then yes. But look, people who buy government bonds today are buying it with a certain promise that they're assuming that the entity will not pay them back only if it goes bankrupt. Now, I can imagine a situation where it makes sense for the U.S. government to go bankrupt. It's certainly better than the U.S. government printing money. But again, I'd like to see that happen only as it moves towards freedom. So it would be moral, it would be rational in the context of going bankrupt in an effort to restructure itself, in a sense, to come out of bankruptcy, a laissez-faire or close to laissez-faire capitalist economy. This is a question about anti-Semitism. So what is the explanation for the grotesque amount of anti-Semitism today? Just YouTube any video about Jews or Israel, the questioner says, and the majority of the comments are viciously hateful towards the Jewish people. I also noticed that there's a connection between anti-Semitism and anti-capitalism. Now, this is a big question that it's going to be hard to answer in just a few minutes, but let me point in a few directions for thought. First, as a culture becomes more collectivist, it becomes more racist. And anti-Semitism is a form of racism, whether Jews are a race or not. It's a form of discrimination based on ethnicity or race. It's a form of racism. And as a culture becomes more collectivist, it becomes more racist. And if you think about American culture, certain forms of racism are just not politically correct. They're just out, so outside of the mainstream that even these nutcases would feel uncomfortable doing it. You know, and therefore, I think Jews are an ancient, old target, and it resurfaces as we become more and more collective. In addition, people become, when they're collectivists, they become more racist in times of crisis, in times of stress, when they're looking for somebody to blame for something gone wrong in their lives or in the lives of the people around them. So when you think about financial crises, when you think about economic crises, when you think about wars, that's when, in a collectivistic culture, people are looking for scapegoats. People are looking for somebody to attack. And again, the Jews are a convenient source for that. Now, there's another element to this. You know, there's always been racism. So one of the reasons they're anti-Semitic today is because there's a tradition of being anti-Semitic. You know, people latch on to what everybody's always done. I mean, these are not exactly original thinkers here who exhibit these ideas and these behaviors. So anti-Semitic has long historical roots that have to do with religion. They have to do with the other, the hatred of people who are different than you, that dress different than you, have different habits than you, that different ceremonies and rituals than you, and it has to do with that. But it also has to do, and you allude to this in the sense of anti-capitalism, with the fact that Jews have been very successful, primarily very successful in the areas of finance. And I've got an essay on usury. I think it's called In Defense of Usury. I encourage you, if you look it up on the web, if you do a search on usury, Yaron Brook, you will find this essay. And it documents the history of usury, the history of an approach to interest in usury. And what's interesting is that I link that to anti-Semitism because for a variety of reasons that have to do with biblical interpretation of all things, Jews became the money users of the Middle Ages, where Christians were not allowed to do that. And therefore, they were hated for it because usury at the time was considered a mortal sin, and yet the Christians needed to borrow the money. The only people who could do it were the Jews. The Jews were making money off of these loans, and they hated them. And, you know, some of the pogroms, they basically wiping out of whole Jewish communities back then, was an attempt to wipe out debts. You know, often, most of the time, these the books that documented who owned who what disappeared at the same time as these people, as these Jews were being slaughtered. So there was this link in people's mind, money-making, banking, usury, selfishness, hatred. Right, and therefore, usury, money lending, banking, all attributes of capitalism. We hate capitalism. We hate the Jews. Now, Marx, who was Jewish, wrote an essay about this issue, and I encourage anybody, everybody, to read this. And if you're interested in capitalism, if you're interested in the attacks on capitalism, or if you're interested in anti-Semitism, go read Karl Marx's essay on the Jewish question. And there he describes why he hates the Jews. He was a huge anti-Semite. He hates the Jews. Why? Because they're self-interested, because they're pursuing profit, because they're pursuing money, but because they're selfish. He talks about that. You know, they're making their lives better off. And it's a fascinating, very philosophical essay about Marx, what really motivated Marx, which was a hatred of self-interest. What really motivated Marx was a hatred of individualism. And he saw those as characteristics of the Jews in the 19th century and hated the Jews for that. And again, collectivists hate Jews, hate capitalism, because capitalism is pro-individual, pro-self-interest, pro-profit, and Jews have become a symbol of those attributes. So here's a quick question. What does objectivism have to say about charging usury or interest? Objectivism is all for charging usury or interest. Usury is just a high interest. In Middle Ages times, usury was interest. Usury equaled interest. At a certain point, the church found that inconvenient because economic activity requires charging of interest. So it created two concepts, the concept of usury, which was unacceptably high interest, and interest, which was acceptable to the church interest. Both are fine if they're done voluntarily in the marketplace. There's absolutely no reason why I should lend my money, which I could use to invest or use to buy more ice cream, to somebody and not expect to get something in return for lending them that money. Banking, finance, lending money is an incredible productive activity. I encourage anybody who has questions about this to read both my article on usury which you can find if you just Google usury in my name, or I have a course that is sold on the Ayn Rand bookstore. I think it's the Ayn Rand Institute e-store in defense of financial markets, where I defend bankers and the whole institution of banking from the historical attacks on it. And I included in that is a discussion of usury and interest. So those are two sources for getting an elaborate, extensive discussion of that. Another quick question about the coming economic collapse. What do I think about Australia as an alternative to America? And then, do I think the Australian sense of life resembles that of the American, and if so, why? And yes, I do think there's a certain sense in which the Australian sense of life resembles that of the American. Not quite. American is still healthier, still better, particularly in its 50, 100, 150 years ago. But there's a certain something about Australia as well. It's a land of immigrants. It's a land of pioneers. It's an environment in which you had to shape the environment in order to survive. Survival wasn't easy. What Australia lacks are the founding principles of this country, and that's why the sense of life is not quite the American sense of life. What they lack is the idea instituted into our founding documents of individual rights, of the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which I think are ideas that have profound impact on the American spirit, on the American way of life, on the American sense of life. Do I think Australia is an alternative to America when the collapse happens? No, I don't. Australia will be a disaster if the United States collapses economically. And again, I've said in other answers to various podcasts, I don't think that's imminent. I do think it'll happen sometime, but I don't think it's imminent. Australia is very dependent right now on export of raw materials. The export of raw materials will decline substantially if there's economic collapse here or in China or both. I just don't see Australia escaping the kind of disaster that would happen to the world if the United States collapsed. Next question is, do you believe totalitarianism is a sustainable model, or will it eventually collapse into laissez-faire capitalism? Well, that's a false dichotomy, false alternative. The world is not comprised of totalitarianism on one side and laissez-faire capitalism on the other. The world is comprised primarily of a mixture in between. And I think those mixtures can survive for a very long term. They can move aggressively towards more totalitarianism, can engage in totalitarianism. But that totalitarianism is not sustainable, if that's the question. It's not. The human spirit cannot be subjugated forever, particularly if there's knowledge out there, even if it's hidden knowledge, of an alternative. So we came out of the Dark Ages when Aristotle was discovered. If there's a future totalitarian regime, hopefully we'll come out of it when Ayn Rand is discovered or when Aristotle is rediscovered. So as long as there are good ideas out there, as long as people can still think, and as long as there's opportunity to capture old knowledge, I think totalitarianism is always going to collapse. The question is, what does it collapse into? And I'm not sure it collapses into laissez-faire capitalism, collapses into some kind of mixture. One day, if Ayn Rand's writings survive, if objectivism survives, then I think we will have a world in which there's laissez-faire capitalism. And that, in my view, is a sustainable model.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peakoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.